from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The worst Ebola outbreak in history has taken thousands of lives in West Africa. As of today, one in the United States. Thomas Duncan, the man who flew in from Liberia, who walked into a Dallas hospital, has died. And everyone is watching, wondering, are we ready for this? Two vulnerabilities for any country, lots of poverty and lots of uninsured. The U.S. has both. The CDC says we'll stop Ebola in its tracks. That would be good. This hour on Point, Ebola readiness in the USA. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you confident the U.S. is ready to handle Ebola? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. On Sunday on ABC's This Week, CDC head Tom Frieden said he is not worried about an outbreak of Ebola here in the United States.
Here in the U.S., I remain quite confident we will not have a widespread outbreak. We will stop it in its tracks because we've got infection control in hospitals and public health that tracks and isolates people if they get symptoms.
So let's look at American preparedness. Joining me first today from New York is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Lori Garrett, senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1996 for her reporting on the Ebola outbreak then in Zaire, much smaller than today's. She is author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance, and Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Lori Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. You write so incisively about this. Let me just ask you about Tom Frieden's characterization there, if I may, Lori. He says, we will stop it in its tracks. Do you share that confidence?
In general terms, yes, I do, although I think there are a lot of holes in our safety net. Holes that we're struggling to fill and holes that we've been trying to fill ever since the anthrax mailings of 2001 and the heightened state of bioterrorism alert that went through the entire Bush administration.
I'm reading here a piece from you, Lori, in Foreign Policy, where you say Canada is better positioned fundamentally to deal with Ebola than the U.S. Why?
Well, this is the key flaw we have. Our Achilles heel is not what's inside our hospitals and what kind of protective gear our health workers are wearing, which appears to be the issue in Spain, where there's now two infected nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Our frailty is who doesn't go to the hospital in the first place, because we have three problems that lead to people underutilizing hospital services. First is a huge uninsured population, roughly 43 million people. They're not going to go to a hospital if they think it's going to cost them any money. The second is working families who are on the edge financially. Every day off from work, every amount of time taken away from work is costing them, and they make choices all the time. Can we afford to take the time away from work to go to the hospital or not? And sort of self-diagnose and decide, oh, it's just a little fever, I'll stay home.
So that's the poverty. That's the poverty problem, in effect.
The working family issue is not necessarily poverty. They may be middle class,
yeah,
but they feel that they can't afford to take time away from the job.
Mm-hmm.
And then our third group, of course, is people who have insurance, but the copay is exorbitant. And so they resist going, again, for financial reasons. The end result is that we have anywhere from 60 to 100 million Americans who routinely make choices when they feel ill or when some member of their family feels ill. Is this a bad enough illness that we need to stay home or we need to go to the hospital, or can we tough it out? And I think then there's another whole issue, which is that men are more prone to decide to tough out any ailment than women are. So you have this, huge number of people all across America that make decisions when there are infections roaming around, whether it's flu or the new enterovirus that's got polio-like symptoms or the Ebola threat. And if people don't seek diagnosis when they have a fever immediately, number one, their possibility of being treated through the illness and surviving drops dramatically. And number two, they can infect everybody they come in contact with, family members, coworkers, kids at school, the person you buy your Dunkin' Donuts from in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's possible to really have a spread of illness in our society simply because We have so many millions of people who, just for financial and time consideration reasons, avoid seeking medical care.
Lori, those problems, uninsured, living on the edge, can't afford a copay, impoverished, those sound more like third world problems. We've seen those with Ebola or afraid they might have it or might get it in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, running away from workers, avoiding medical workers. We don't think of those as American dynamics, but if they come into play, how could these play out for better or worse, for ill, in the Ebola case? The dynamics, the fundamentals you're describing there, how would those intersect with Ebola if and when we've got it walking around more in this country?
Well, here's a good example. In 2009, we had the famous swine flu epidemic, the H1N1 flu. And that appears to have first struck in the late winter of 2009, but didn't really go noticed until Mexico realized it had this huge problem, which, as it turns out, they got from us. And that was close to April, May. By May, Americans were just beginning to wake up and realize that, oh my goodness, there's this infection problem, and you had a whole group of school children in New York City that were infected and quarantined briefly. Well, as it turns out, by the time Americans woke up and realized the flu was out there and it was a new flu, according to the CDC, 14 million of us were already infected. So it was a little late. And it meant that we didn't really have the ability to do much to control it, and it spread all over all 50 states and, of course, eventually all over the entire world.
But isn't Ebola fundamentally different? I mean, it just doesn't travel like flu, right?
Oh, right. I want to be very careful about that. Thank you, Tom, because I do not want people to think that I'm comparing it to flu because I think they're biologically of equal risk or transmission possibility. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. In fact, the interesting thing is both the Pew Organization and Gallup have done polls recently on American public opinion about Ebola. And Gallup went the extra 9 yards in a poll released this week comparing its poll results in 2009 regarding Americans' fears of swine flu to its poll results for Ebola. What's really, really striking is that they're almost identical, which is to say almost the exact same number of Americans seem to think that they personally are at risk of acquiring Ebola compared to swine flu. Almost the same number think somebody in their family is going to get it. Almost the same number believe there's going to be an epidemic, and it breaks down across the same political and racial lines.
But you're here to say none of those things are true, and yet, your headline is, you are not nearly scared enough about Ebola.
You're not scared enough about Ebola in the context of what it's doing to Africa, of what it's going to mean for the whole future of global capacity to deal with infectious diseases and outbreaks, our global solidarity, the disruption of African economies, all of that. But I do not think that the average American, as reflected in these polls, is properly assessing their personal risk. There is absolutely no way the risk to an American today of Ebola is in any way comparable to the risk that we all shared in 2009 to flu. And it's interesting to me that the more Republican an individual self-declares, all the way out to being a Tea Party member, and the more they say they do not trust Barack Obama, the greater their fear of Ebola. And the more they identify as a Democrat and admire the president, the less their fear of Ebola. So we actually have a partisan divide in fearfulness.
That's kind of wild. I'm going to try and sidestep the partisan divide, though duly noted, and it's very interesting. But we want to look at real risk here and real response, capacity to respond. Lori, we've got lots of callers already for you. Susan's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Susan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I just think that the bigger impact is going to be exposing the fragmentation of our healthcare system. As a physician, I just think this points out how fragmented we are. We have multiple levels of healthcare delivery, multiple levels of insurance. These systems do not communicate with each other. I know the CDC monitors Ebola, obviously, but I don't think, you know, within institutions and across institutions, there's communication about this. And I think that ultimately this epidemic is going to point out how fragmented we are and hopefully might push more consolidation so that there's better communication and better management of this kind of an outbreak.
Susan, if Ebola comes into your doctor's office, I mean, you are a physician, or your hospital, are you confident, like the CDC director, that we'll stop it in its tracks?
Well, I think that the issue is of identifying it, because fever is an extremely common presenting symptom, and you would not be able to distinguish whether or not someone has Ebola based on that alone, obviously. And somebody might come in impaired and encephalopathic or unconscious and not be able to indicate that they were exposed to somebody with Ebola or somebody or traveled to West Africa. So I think there's a lot of holes in that, obviously.
Is your staff ready, Susan? Is your staff ready? Do they know how to respond? Susan?
I don't know that locally, that there's, like you said, that there's not been a lot of education of the local institutions specifically. I have not received any emails or any direct education in this topic. So I don't know that all the institutions across the country have adequate education of their healthcare providers in that regard.
The training may not have come. Ebola may come. We've already got it in Dallas. Susan in Cleveland, thanks for calling. Lori Garrett, it's great to have you. Please stand by, New York Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. Won a Pulitzer for her reporting on the outbreak of Ebola in Zaire. 1996. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Ebola and the USA, how we are and are not perhaps prepared to deal with it, if and when and however it may come to these shores. Lori Garrett is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, for her reporting, her explanatory journalism on a big outbreak of Ebola in Zaire back in the 90s. Big, but not nearly as big as what we're looking at right now. Joins us today from New York. Here was the president at the White House on Monday assuring the public that the U.S. would not face an Ebola epidemic.
Because of the measures that we've put in place, as well as our world-class health system, and the nature of the Ebola virus itself, which is difficult to transmit, the chances of an Ebola outbreak in the United States is extremely low.
Extremely low. Here's New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer, same on Monday, saying at a news conference, we need a database of people who have traveled to West Africa.
We would ask that hospitals be given a list of all travelers who were very recently in the countries that are the Ebola hotspots, so they might pay a little extra attention when someone came in with potentially Ebola-like symptoms.
Everybody trying to figure it out. Here's Texas Governor Rick Perry on Monday saying there must be more that can be done.
Those steps may be something as simple as taking their temperature. These much-needed screening procedures will also necessitate fully staffed, prepared quarantine stations wherever people are entering the country.
Lori Garrett, stand by in New York. Lots of questions for you. Timothy in Burlington, Vermont, you're on with Lori Garrett.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've been to West Africa, and just as an aside, there are other contagious or transmittable diseases in that part of the world, such as typhoid and cholera and HIV. That's in part of the mix. But I wanted to know, do the health authorities, are they taking in consideration that now if the president has sent U.S. troops over there, when they return at some point, might not they be contagious or perhaps help spread the disease on U.S. territory?
We'll pick it up. Timothy, thanks for your call. Lori, how about it? U.S. troops headed over to West Africa. They will eventually come home. Talk to us about those returnees and, for that matter, all travelers between these regions and the U.S. and how we ought to look at them. You know, as you know, Lori, there are some calls, Bobby Jindal, Louisiana, says shut down travel here.
So I wrote in Foreign Policy this week, and I stand by it 100%. We are on the cusp of development of a rapid diagnostic blood test that can tell who's infected and who's not infected. And all of this business about screening people at airports with current available technology, it boils down to what do you look like, what's your stated travel history, what does it say on your itinerary, and do you have a fever, all of which would have allowed Thomas Eric Duncan to get through, except for his answer to had he been around anybody with Ebola in Liberia.
He lied about that.
And this is false, false, false. safety. The real thing we need is a rapid diagnostic, and I'm happy to report that three companies are working at a feverish pace on very, very promising technologies, and our FDA has committed to very rapidly assessing and approving them so they can go into very rapid commercial development.
What does that mean, Lori? A rapid point-of-care diagnostic? You're talking about sort of a diabetes-style little prick of the finger for a tiny
right.
blood?
Exactly. I mean, my proposal is that countries that have Ebola in their borders would require, in order to exit the country, that in addition to having a plane ticket and all that, you would arrive an hour earlier than usual at the airport.
Okay.
And you would be, after you went through security, you would be set aside in a secure area you could not leave.
Yep.
And given a self-administered pinprick device.
Mm-hmm.
You squeeze a droplet into a tiny plate about an inch in size, and it will the plate will pick up, depending on which assay is used, either antibodies or DNA genes that say this is Ebola. And if you tested positive, obviously you wouldn't be allowed to board the flight.
Will your blood indicate that, Lori, even if you've just been infected? Does it instantly show up in a way that would be detected by such a test in the blood?
That kind of question is being answered right now in trials of these various pinprick approaches. So we don't have an absolute answer to that yet. But the point is, you sure wouldn't get it just by looking for fever, because the person just exposed isn't going to have a fever for many days.
But that's what I mean, I'm just getting news right now. I don't know if you've seen this yet. This is CNN saying that airports in the United States will begin taking the temperatures of arriving passengers with flight itineraries originating in West African countries infected here. They'll begin this weekend. You're saying not worth it? How soon can you have your diagnostic test in there?
Well, I think that people are moving at a feverish pace to try and get those diagnostics rolled out. I think it's the only answer, because fever only is when you are symptomatic, which is days after your exposure to the virus. So, I mean, this is it's going to calm some political nerves. You know, maybe Bobby Jindal will feel it's adequate or something, but it's not going to provide that 100% margin of protection that some Americans feel is necessary in order to make them feel comfortable. And, the other thing beautiful about a point-of-care diagnostic is that, you know, instead of putting 21 people under surveillance at tremendous cost and difficulty for them in the Dallas area, we could quickly do pinprick tests and know exactly who was and was not exposed to the virus.
How soon? What's the best case here?
One company told me a week ago that they thought they would be prepared to start commercial production in 30 days.
Let us put that, Lori, with you, but since you've done so much reporting in Africa on Ebola, up against some of the numbers, the projections out of there, which with exponential increase become so frightening. I mean, in one of the stories I'm reading, you talking about almost a million potential deaths in Liberia and Sierra Leone. What are the chances, to your mind at this point, of it running up that high in West Africa? And if it does, can the United States, with all of its resources, build a medical wall high enough to keep it out?
Well, first of all, a medical wall, there is no such thing. We're in the age of globalization. This isn't ships coming to Ellis Island 100 years ago. This is, you know, welcome to, you just got on an airplane. You don't even know you were exposed. And in fact, one of the interesting things you can see is that every single one of the healthcare workers that has acquired Ebola and survived it, either in Europe or the United States, is saying on interview they cannot recall anything they did that could explain how they got infected in the first place. And I think, you know, it's very important for people to understand. It's not as if lots of people are running around knowingly infected or knowingly having put themselves at risk. So most of the social approaches are not going to work. And meanwhile, you know, this epidemic is growing exponentially every 15 to 20 days.
Do you buy the estimate of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine you're quoting here? They're saying by February, Ebola could have killed 980,000 Liberians and Sierra Leoneans. You say a number so apocalyptic as to defy our imaginations. Does that seem like some real extreme projection to you or within the realm of reasonable likelihood?
Well, I derive the number based on the CDC's forecast of a worst-case scenario of 1.4 million cases by February 1st, and then the London School's analysis of why it is that we're underestimating mortality right now, because we mostly are taking a snapshot at a given moment, and it looks like about half have died. But true mortality is 70%. So that 980,000 is simply 70% of 1.4 million. And today, the World Bank, just about an hour and a half ago, released a report looking at their forecast for the economic impact, again, on just three countries, just Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, not even dealing with spillover into other countries, either on the African continent or elsewhere. And they are making enormously frightening economic projections for the area and roughly accepting the CDC's range of estimates for the possibility of where this epidemic is going. Now, nobody wants to be wrong about these estimates more than me. And what we have to pray is that somehow the global response to assist these countries is going to rev up way beyond where it is right now and do so fast enough to stop the spread of this virus.
So you're standing by this number. I mean, we've got the 3,000 plus dead now. You're standing by this real possibility of almost a million dead by February?
Well, again, exponential growth,
yeah,
and underreporting. So everybody pretty much agrees that everybody, meaning WHO, CDC, most of the health observers, agree that the vast majority of the sick and the dead are never getting caught in the number count because they're not coming into health facilities. And they're out in the villages, they're out in their neighborhoods in the big cities, and
yeah,
Nobody's capturing those numbers. So the CDC's best guess is that any given set of numbers you hear on a given day are off by an order of 2.5.
Wow. Lori, I've only got you for another couple of minutes. Run us through, if you would, the critical path in your view. Number one, you want this rapid point-of-care diagnostic, pinprick blood test right there so we know. What else? Go down your quick checklist for the United States.
And if you know who's infected, then you can isolate
yeah
them from their families and the rest of the populations
mm-hmm
and stop the spread within that social setting.
And you don't have to follow hundreds or thousands of people all over the place all the time. You'll know.
You'll know. And furthermore, you don't risk making someone infected who wasn't in the first place just because they have a high fever and you put them in a room with other people who have fevers from Ebola. Now you can actually, with this point of care, we'll be able to tell which one with a high fever has malaria and should be over here being treated, and which one with a high fever has Ebola and should be over there being treated. I mean, right now, the hospitals are essentially spreading disease.
And people come into the emergency room if they don't have health insurance and sit and wait, among others.
Exactly, and thereby possibly spread disease to other people in that waiting room, where wait times can be up to 12 or 14 hours, depending on what kind of hospital you're waiting in the United States.
But with all that, at the very outset, you said you're optimistic we will get on top of this in this country, Lori. I've just got you for 30 seconds more. Tell us why, after those scary numbers. And
well, in this country, what's to get on top of? We have one case.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody is so overreacting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is mind-boggling. One case.
Thank heavens. Let's hold it just as close to one as we can. Lori Garrett, you're terrific. We always enjoy speaking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you to you and your audience.
Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of the Ebola outbreak in Zaire, then Zaire, in 1996, much smaller than our outbreak in Africa right now. Let's turn to another guest here. Amish Adalja joins us right now from Philadelphia. An infectious disease physician at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center focuses on pandemic preparedness, bioterrorism, emerging infectious diseases, Associate Editor of the Journal of Biosecurity and Bioterrorism. Amish Adalja, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You can understand how it's difficult for an ordinary person to keep all these factors well-balanced in mind. On the one hand, we hear we'll stop it in its tracks. On the other hand, we hear right there numbers of deaths potentially in West Africa heading toward 1 million. What's your sense of American readiness at this point, without any exaggeration or under-exaggeration or undercount of the Ebola picture? You know, how ready are we?
You have to remember that Ebola is a deadly disease, a scary disease, but it's not very contagious. And that's kind of the chink in its armor, the fact that you can only get it with exposure to blood and body fluids, and you are not contagious until you get symptoms. That makes control relatively easy and able to be performed with just low-tech interventions. It's not like this outbreak in West Africa is the first time we've ever dealt with Ebola. We've been dealing with Ebola since 1976, and very simple, tried-and-true public health principles have stopped every outbreak.
But not this one. We're talking about potentially nearly a million dead by February. That is far from stopping.
Right. This outbreak is a little bit different, and I think it was underestimated from the beginning because West Africa had never had an Ebola outbreak before, and it took them about 3 months to actually realize they were dealing with Ebola. That put us already behind when we were waiting 3 months to actually know that there was an Ebola outbreak occurring. So the other thing that happened is that these states have emerged from civil wars, and there is a lot of distrust amongst the population with their government, and they don't necessarily heed public health issues. And we saw reports of people running from Red Cross trucks, hiding bodies, not believing that Ebola existed, using alternative cures. And then you've got this three-border region, which is where the epicenter of the outbreak is, and that border region isn't really a recognized tribal borders. Those are all colonial borders. So people freely move across those borders, making control and coordination much, much harder.
What about Lori Garrett's point that in this country we have plenty in poverty, we have 40 million plus uninsured, we have people, low-wage people who don't want to take a day off work, who are, you know, just may tough it out. You're talking about people avoiding care in West Africa. What about her concern here on that front? Do you share it, Amish, or not?
Not so much with respect to this Ebola outbreak. Those are definite issues that make control of infectious disease hard in this country for certain pockets of the population, for example, with tuberculosis, sexually transmitted diseases, for example. But you have to keep in mind that we had imported cases of Ebola both in Nigeria and Senegal. And with their level of public health infrastructure, they were able to stop those chains of transmissions in their countries. And I believe if Senegal and Nigeria can stop a chain of transmission, the U.S. can.
That's a pretty big deal. Is it clear? Are people confident that they've got it shut down in those countries? I guess they have to stay vigilant since it's next door.
Right. You have to wait 2 incubation periods from your last case, so 42 days in order to actually consider that it's clear. But all indications are that those two countries have handled their Ebola outbreak. And you have to remember, we also have a concurrent Ebola outbreak going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And really nobody is worried about that because we know that the DRC has been able to handle Ebola outbreaks since 1976 and that they're very good at contact tracing. And like I just want to emphasize again, it's very low-tech approaches that stop Ebola outbreaks. It's not a very contagious disease.
Why do they want to kill the Spanish nurse's dog? Can pets, dogs, carry Ebola?
Theoretically, certain mammal species may be susceptible to Ebola, and what I think they believe is that this animal may have been exposed to it since she has it, and that's the easiest mechanism to control infection is to have the dog put down, but that's very controversial.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ebola and the USA, how we are and are not prepared to deal with it. Amish Adalja joins us. He is an infectious disease physician at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. With us today from Philadelphia. Amish, so many callers for you. Marion in Monticello, Kentucky. You're on the air. Thank you for calling, Marion.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, what is the life for the virus once it has contaminated a surface? How long is that virus capable of infecting a human or mammal host?
Great question. Thank you, Marion. Amish?
So there's been some lab studies that have looked at how long Ebola can survive or be viable outside of an animal host. And it's about, at the longest, it's 6 days. But I would say I would interpret that number with caution because that was in an ideal setting where the humidity, the temperature, the environmental conditions were controlled. In all reality, it's probably about 24 hours, and especially on blood spots where the virus remains viable. It's not a very hardy virus. It's not like a spore of anthrax that can survive for decades and decades outside of an animal host. This is not a very powerful virus in terms of its ability to survive.
And what kind of contact is necessary? I mean, we heard about people in West Africa being driven around in taxis looking for some hospital where they could be left, you know, and they're obviously leaving fluids on that taxi seat. If you're the next one in there and you've got on short pants or lean your arm against the upholstery, is it as easy as that or not, Bruce?
Ebola has to find a way into your body. So that's usually through mucous membrane exposures, through your mouth, through your nose, through open cuts and abrasions. Intact skin, technically, it shouldn't be able to penetrate. However, any kind of exposure like that, if you've just come from an area where someone's body fluids are there, is a significant exposure and should be treated as such. And those vehicles should be decontaminated appropriately.
Touch your leg, touch your nose, and you're into mucous membrane. Bruce in Essex, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Tom?
Hi, yes, you're on, sir.
Yeah, I want to express my concern about the suicidal practice of using standard hazmat suits to give the illusion of protection.
Why do you say suicidal, Bruce? What do you mean?
Because I can sit at my desk here and look at Time magazine and see pictures of the standard hazmat suits where the opening around the face is open. And people are wearing a gauze mask of some sort over their mouth and nose with plastic goggles on the outside so that any liquid can attach. To be safe in those conditions, the suit should actually be one piece from the neck down.
The neck down or the top of the head down?
No. Follow me here, Tom. Mm-hmm. The basic suit should be from the neck down, one piece with a large neck opening with a drawstring so that the suit, to remove it is the danger here, the suit should be able to open up the neck and pull it down, turning it inside out as you go so there's no danger of touching the inside. The head should actually be a hood with an attached plastic face shield on it.
Bruce, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Roll it down, keep it away from the body as we go. Amos, you must have seen a lot of these photographs. We all have at this point. We may soon see American military in some kind of suits in West Africa. What do you think of what you're generally seeing in terms of the equipment being used, the suits in particular, by health workers? A surprising portion of those who have died in West Africa have been health workers.
Ebola disproportionately infects healthcare workers, and that's because of the lack of personal protective equipment being used in all situations. And the caller makes a great point that it's not just putting on the personal protective equipment, it's actually taking it off. And we're seeing some early reports that the Spanish nurse who was infected actually may have touched her face while she was taking off her personal protective equipment. You don't need to wear spacesuits and hazmat suits, and sometimes when you do go over and above what's required, you make it harder to get out of those things and you can contaminate yourself. Really what you need are gowns, gloves, masks, eye protection, and fluid impervious gowns. That's what you need. In Africa, it's a little bit different because there's so much cross-contamination going on, so people are wearing much more personal protective equipment, but it is very important that you take off the equipment appropriately.
And very good protocol on getting out of that equipment. Brian in Oklahoma City. Brian, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the country, from the president to the head of the CDC to the governor of Texas, says that we are prepared for Ebola. My wife works for a major hospital in Oklahoma City, and just this morning, everybody was gathered up in a meeting, and they were told that they were finally updating their triage questionnaires to include Ebola-related questions. I just wanted to put that out there and get a comment to see how prepared we really are with that information.
Yeah, it may seem late in the game there. On the other hand, we've only got one case so far. But Amish, what's your sense of how rapidly the American medical system is gearing up awareness, preparedness?
So there's been definitely a lot of communication from the CDC and state health departments to their member hospital to the hospitals across this country. I can't speak for every hospital system, but the one I work at, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, we've been looking at Ebola for months now and have come up with a comprehensive protocol and guidance that will guide the clinician from the point of entry of an Ebola, a suspected Ebola patient, all the way through their hospital stay, looking at how they'll be isolated, what kind of lab tests will be done, who we will notify, what kind of personal protective equipment we'll use, where their waste will go. All of that's been done. And I think that's something that all hospitals need to be doing now, because we do all face the possibility of imported cases happening in Dallas. And I can't emphasize enough that hospitals need to emphasize asking travel history in their patients that may have been to those countries, because that's our linchpin in our defense, is asking travel history.
Edith in Canton, Connecticut. Edith, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. My concern is the quick rush by some pharmaceutical companies to come up with a drug that would be helpful, and I hope that is so, but I'm concerned about drugs that have been on the books for years that then have to be recalled. So I know we're dealing with a very serious disease here, and I wonder if stopping travel from these states for the time being and treating with the best possible treatment in that country would help prevent some of our concerns right now.
You're saying stop travel out of West Africa, I guess you mean in particular, or these three countries in particular. Edith, let us pick it up. Amish, stand by to help us do that. Erwin Redlener joins us right now from New York, professor of health policy and management at Columbia University, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia. Erwin Redlener, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
What do you say to Edith's suggestion out of Connecticut? It's the same Bobby Jindal's made out of Louisiana, saying, hey, let's just shut down this travel for now until we're really sure we're ready.
Well, you know, that's kind of a pie-in-the-sky answer to a much more complex challenge. It has to do with the reality that many, many people from West African countries, including those three, happen to live in the United States, and in some places in high concentration, including, interestingly, Dallas, but also New York City and other places.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are going back and forth. They're visiting. They're traveling. There's a great deal of commerce that goes on between West African countries and other countries.
But Edith says that's fine, but not now. Let's shut it down now.
Well, then what happens? How do we get aid workers in and out of there? There's all sorts of reasons why that would be very, very difficult to do and cause even the potential of political unrest in countries that are basically walled off from the rest of the world right now. In effect, we'd be talking about quarantining a country or several countries, and I think it's exceedingly impractical and also not really necessary to do what we have to do, certainly in the United States. There's a lot of things that we need to do in those particular countries, but again, as you've been emphasizing, everyone's been talking about, we have a total of one case, the United States of America right now, and shutting off three countries in West Africa that are really suffering right now is not, it would not be my first choice at all of the strategies that we need to think about.
Sam in Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. You know, I have a little bit of a problem, and we forget exactly what the literature and the all various social research and all has said. As a physician and an epidemiologist, for that matter, I know that protocol is only protocol when it's universally enforced.
Yes.
And applied.
Mm-hmm.
When a protocol becomes stratified according to who gets what, when, and how, you know, are you black, are you white, are you Asian, are you Hispanic? The point that any person is telling me that is miscommunication, that someone showed up an emergency room and was turned away, even though you were told that person came from West Africa. Never mind Liberia.
You're talking about the Dallas example where Mr. Duncan went to the hospital, told them, and was sent away anyway. What are you saying, Sam? Are you charging racism here?
Absolutely, there's no question. If you go and subpoena all the records and go through it, you will find out. Because Tom, the basic principle of medicine, at least I was taught, and I use, No, if I have a patient, the first one of the questions I'll ask, have you traveled anywhere? Where have you been to? That's part of clinical medicine. So, I mean, how could that be miscommunication when it's in part of the number one, the crown jewel, the basic fundamentals of clinical medicine?
Sam, we've got it. I very much appreciate your call. Of course, Mr. Duncan did tell them he'd been in Liberia. That did not get that did not go on up as it should have, and he was sent away from the hospital. Erwin, we've got others here expressing concern about this. Edward writes online, Katrina comes to mind. Hurricane Katrina, and I guess, you know, populations kind of left unserved when the trouble comes down.
You know, it's always possible, especially unfortunately in the U.S., that's an issue. But I think there's bigger fish to fry here in terms of what the problems are with the issue of protocols, what's being done, et cetera. First of all, I think people should be aware of the fact that the funding for hospital preparedness in terms of disasters has been cut essentially in half from 2004 to now. So the funding that the hospitals were depending on to establish the protocols, the principles, and the training, which is particularly important, is basically drying up as we're watching it. And second of all, there's been probably a 30% or so cutback in funding for local health departments. That those are the folks that do the early identification protocols, the tracking of contacts, and really stopping the spread. Now, Tom Frieden, who's a spectacularly capable CDC director, the CDC is not running these local health departments or state health departments. And the money and the staffing for these departments across the country is way down. We've lost about 50,000 public health jobs in the last 4 or 5 years. And we're not equipped. And I'm really not worried about Ebola becoming an epidemic like the other experts were talking. We're all saying the same thing. What I am worried about is the next thing that's going to happen, where we really need to be top of our game in terms of screening, identification, tracking, treating, and so forth. But right now, our country is highly vulnerable, not in the same way that Africa is. And the reason that is that we can do the basics pretty well. I mean, a lot of people die in Africa from Ebola because, among other things, they're dehydrated. There's no hand-washing facilities in many of the hospitals. Electricity is down for, you know, many, many hours during the day. The infrastructure is completely crumbled in a lot of these states in Africa. That's not the case here. But what is the case here is a very significant and scary lack of training and readiness of the hospitals and the public health departments locally to do what they have to do. There's some exceptions. New York City, L.A., and Miami, there are places where they have stepped up their game. Even so, we'll probably get a case or two or maybe even more than that in the country, but we're not going to get an epidemic.
If I may, Andrew, in Saranac Lake, New York. Andrew, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My question is, what is the risk of the mutation of the virus itself when it's able to infect so many different people as it has in this case? Can it mutate to a version that's more infectious, and will we be able to counter that quickly when it does happen?
Andrew, thank you. Amish Adalja, what do you say, sir?
All viruses mutate. For example, HIV, influenza, that's a normal part of the life cycle of a virus to mutate. And it's important to look at this Ebola outbreak strain and see how it evolves through the number of people that it's infecting. However, it's not really a strong possibility that this could change the way the virus behaves. We've seen that this is a pretty stable virus, about 95% the same as throughout this outbreak. And I would make the point that there's a lot of concern about airborne transmission of this virus, but we've never seen a virus that spreads by blood and body fluids but get airborne characteristics. Think of HIV, for example.
And it's not the case with this Ebola. Now, it's not a transmittable airborne, and you're saying it's unlikely to mutate there.
Right, and it's not like mutations are just a switch that gets flipped by a virus. There's a lot of evolutionary trade-off that has to occur for a virus to do things. And who's to say that if it gets a mutation, that mutation is advantageous for it, or that it keeps its same amount of deadliness? There's a lot of – it's just not a one-to-one trade-off that a lot of people think that mutations are always going to make something better or worse – better, because they may make them actually worse.
We heard at the top of the hour Erwin Redlener from Lori Garrett saying her number one must-do here is a rapid point-of-care diagnostic kit where you can do a pinprick and know in an airport or wherever if you're infected or not. Do you see that coming on the scene in time to be helpful here, Erwin?
Well, I, It depends what you mean. It would be helpful if we had it right this second. It would be helpful if we had it, you know, 2 months ago. Whenever we get it, it's going to be helpful.
And 5 years from now might be a little late with this outbreak.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, it's a relative answer. I mean, the sooner the better, I guess, is what I would like to say about that. And I know we're working feverishly in a couple of different labs to get this fine-tuned and ready for prime time, but the fact is we still need to get this done. As it is, there are certain tests that we can do that actually can be available in terms of results within a number of hours, you know, 4 to 6 hours, let's say. Part of the challenge is, do we have local labs so we're not having to send the specimens to Atlanta, et cetera? And over the last few years, there are many, many more local labs that can do these tests. They're called PCR tests.
Do you think we'll keep Ebola to single digits in this country? It's at 1 right now. Single digits, double digits, triple digits? What's your best projection, Erwin?
Double digits.
Double digits in this outbreak. Wow. While those numbers go so high in Africa, that would be great. We hope it happens. We've learned a lot today. Erwin Redlener at Columbia University, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
And Amos Adalja of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Amos Adalja, thank you as well. Wonderful to have you with us from Philadelphia today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for all your input and questions, your comments online. You can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. This is On Point.